Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On June 6, 1944, Allied forces landed on the beaches of Normandy. D-Day was the largest seaborne invasion in history. More than 160,000 Allied troops, 5,000 ships, 13,000 aircraft. They were led by General Dwight D. Eisenhower. And on that day, Eisenhower carried a note in his wallet. And Susan, I wonder if you could you read that note for us?
Our landings in Cherbourg Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based on the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone.
So, it is mine alone. That is the memo that Dwight D. Eisenhower wrote, and he carried it in his wallet on D-Day. And the reader of that note is Susan Eisenhower, granddaughter of Dwight Eisenhower. And Susan is also CEO and chairman of the Eisenhower Group. She's author of a new book called How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decision. Susan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Meghna. It's great to be with you.
Also with us is Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, how are you?
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Susan.
So, Jack, I actually want to turn to you first. That letter that Eisenhower wrote and carried with him on D-Day, what do you hear in the words of that letter?
Well, you hear a man taking responsibility. We have a president who some months ago said, I'm not responsible. Someone asked him, are you responsible? He said, I'm not responsible for anything. What a contrast. This moving book is full of words like duty, honor, country, responsibility. And it feels like in every page a kind of repudiation of our present. I know it wasn't written with that in mind, but it reminds you of the great people we have produced, of whom Dwight Eisenhower was a stellar example, and of really how we have declined in our public leadership since then.
Mm. Well, Susan, is that sense of personal responsibility, is that was that through and through in your grandfather as you knew him?
Oh, I should say we had. As young kids, we had plenty of friendly lectures about taking personal responsibility. I think what's extraordinary about that particular memo, the unused communique, I call it, is that Eisenhower was also taking responsibility for the weather forecast, which was one of the critical elements of that operation. Without proper weather conditions, certainly the paratroopers who were going to jump and the Navy who had to navigate the waters, needed the right kind of conditions. And yes, I think it is a rather large contrast to much of what we're hearing and seeing in our culture today.
Huh. Taking responsibility for the weather forecast. I mean, I think it's worth talking a little bit about or remembering the swirl of information and uncertainty that went into the moment where the decision to launch Operation Overlord was made. I mean, you write about this in the book. Can you talk about sort of some of the resistance or concerns that then General Eisenhower was met with prior to D-Day?
Well, you know, Meghna, I think the decision to go during rather turbulent weather. The decision was made to go during turbulent weather, but here's the thing. The meteorology committee thought that maybe there would be an opening in the early hours of the next day, which is June 6th. And it was a critical forecast because going under those conditions came with some advantage, which is that the Germans never imagined that we would be invading anything under those conditions. But I think what made the decision so tense is that the Committee of Weathermen actually didn't agree on the forecast themselves. And in the context of dropping the paratroopers, who were the linchpin of the operation to meet American objectives on the first day, you know, they really do require certain kinds of weather so they can find their targets. And so, you know, altogether, it was a very dire moment. But Eisenhower said, let's go, and then penned that note for his wallet.
Jack, jump in here. What do you think?
Well, the nerve, the courage, the steadiness under pressure, the willingness to listen to discordant opinions and finally to decide, that was the model of his leadership. And it's one of the examples, I think, that Susan rightly cites as sort of worthy of emulation. Listen to people, take their advice, take your own counsel and decide. And he did, perhaps the most fateful decisions, one of the most fateful decisions of the 20th century.
Mm. So Susan, your book goes through these principles, right? The principles behind these momentous, truly historic decisions that that Eisenhower had to make. So what would you say is the key principle or some of the key principles behind, you know, the D-Day decisions?
Well, I like what Jack just said. I think it's absolutely critical to note that Dwight Eisenhower believed in expert opinion. You can't be a successful delegator if you don't have respect for expert opinion. And if you're running an operation of that size, you simply can't run an operation of that size without delegating. I think he had a real talent, too, for empowering the people he delegated to. He had a number of ways of doing that. For instance, he brought these qualities into the White House, but he would always stand up behind the microphone at his weekly press conference, and instead of saying, I have authorized, he would say, I have accepted the recommendation of my Secretary of Transportation, for instance. So he was always empowering his subordinates to make them feel like they had a critical role in what was underway. He used to say that the job of a leader is to take the blame when things go wrong and to give the credit to your subordinates when things go right. That's I think he's correct about that because he brought out the best in people. But again, that's a very hard thing to do, especially in these times.
Yeah. So that basic principle there of leadership accepting blame, but spreading the sources of success around in terms of to their subordinates. Where did that come from? What in his life led him to sort of almost naturally lead like that?
Well, it's interesting you should say that. I've been thinking long and hard about this because he had other principles that were very deeply held. He did not believe in inciting personalities. He thought that if you got up and insulted somebody publicly, you would never again have any chance of cooperation. And given his role during the war, he brought with him to the presidency a commitment to make both sides cooperate so that America could recalibrate itself after the Korean War, and also to recalibrate ourselves for the modernization of our country in the middle of vast technological change. I think his no personalities approach and this taking responsibility, I think, was aided and advanced because he was a man who studied others. In other words, over the course of his life, this observer of men and women actually developed a real philosophy about human nature. And his objective to create a sustainable strategy for our country is based on his capacity as to what other people are prepared to do and for what length of time.
Is that something that you experienced firsthand as his granddaughter? Like, did he cast that observational eye on you?
Actually, that's an excellent question. I think he did, actually. I tell in the book about how tough it is to be the supreme leader or the president of the United States because, you know, that level of power tends to distort relationships, so families become important. But I once made the error of a lifetime, and I accidentally paid no attention as some of the horses I rode, they were his horses, burst through the paddock gate and ran all over the lawn while Granddad and my grandmother were looking out the window, and then made a big sweep and ran right over his putting green, which he had had installed so that he had the capacity to go out and putt in private, you know, without people watching every move and asking for autographs, etc. And he was an observer of me, too. When I came in to face the music, and I thought, you know, this would be a blaring soundtrack, right? he says, you know, when I said your grandmother, I haven't seen horses run like that since I was a kid in Abilene, Kansas. And it was his astute measurement of me to know that I was already devastated. And if he didn't say the right thing, I wouldn't be of sound mind to think about how I had made that error. Now, I was very smart, by the way, Magna and Jack, to take full responsibility for the incident. And I think that bought me a second chance here, right? But he was very gracious about it. And the sad part is that the putting green had to be taken out because it, you know, caught, you know, the lawn was never the same. The green was never the same. And so, anyway, that was my country.
So the desire for to adhere to personal accountability from grandfather to granddaughter, and then he also knew the right thing to say to you. Well, Susan Eisenhower, stand by for just a moment, and Jack Beattie, hang in there as well. We're talking about lessons in leadership from the legacy of General and President Dwight D. Eisenhower. We'll be back with more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Susan Eisenhower. She is the granddaughter of President Dwight D. Eisenhower, and she's also author of the new book, How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. And we have an excerpt of the book, by the way, at onpointradio.org. Jack Beattie is also with us, as always. He's On Point News Analyst, and he's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Susan and Jack, let's get a little bit of the voice of President Eisenhower in here. So I want to play a couple of moments from 1953, because following the death of Joseph Stalin, then President Eisenhower spoke to the American Society of Newspaper Editors about the futility of the Cold War. And he noted that that moment in history, he called it a chance of peace.
What can the world or any nation in it hope for if no turning is found on this dread road. The worst to be feared and the best to be expected can be simply stated. The worst is atomic war. The best would be this: a life of perpetual fear and tension, a burden of arms draining the wealth and labor of all people.
And that life of perpetual fear and tension, Eisenhower said, he said that would be a wasting of strength that defies the American system.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
And there's one more moment we want to play from his 1953 address.
This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. These plain and cruel truths define the peril and point the hope that come with the spring of 1953.
That's President Eisenhower in 1953 speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Now, Susan, you know, Eisenhower had gone from the horrors of the Second World War and the threats of Nazism and fascism. And then he and the world tumble into the potential horrors, nuclear Armageddon, of the Cold War. So can you talk to us a little bit about sort of what principles really animated him during that period, where he was president of the United States? What did he do that really led him, or most overtly demonstrated his commitment to try to keep peace and avoid nuclear Armageddon?
Well, first of all, there are a number of factors there. His first objective as president of the United States, much as it was during the war, was to bring unity of purpose to the United States of America. We had already been in an unpopular war in Korea, and Ike actually believed that small wars could get large, and that if an enemy is losing, they will use everything in their arsenal. And so he did not believe that small interjections here, there, and everywhere would be in any way productive for our national security. So he tried to unite the United States around that idea. It was a very, very tense time within the country, too. The Soviet Union was making advances into Eastern Europe. China had become a communist country. And so, you know, this was a key point. He also believed that the unity of our country, by the way, is a national security issue. Mm-hmm. And I still say that today. I mean, as Ike said, this disunity would be a welcome sight for an alert enemy. And I think that phrase is as apt today as it was then. The other principles he brought to this was, of course, we mentioned it before, expert opinion. And he had an excellent relationship with the scientific community. And in his second term, he actually restructures the government so that he has person-to-person access to Nobel laureates and other great scientists who reported directly to the President of the United States. And then I think the other a principle which is rather novel in today's environment is this no personalities question. Mm-hmm. We were deeply divided internally during the McCarthy period.
Yeah.
And Eisenhower actually managed to avoid, over the course of a year and a half, ever mentioning Senator McCarthy's name, because he did not want to give Senator McCarthy the publicity value of ending up in a debate with the President of the United States. He didn't think that Senator McCarthy should rise to that level. So he crafted a behind-the-scenes strategy that actually worked successfully in finally eliminating Senator McCarthy's influence. And just one other thing to remember here is that he knew that the President of the United States has no authority to censure a renegade senator, that would have to be done by the senators themselves. So he worked behind the scenes to finally bring the majority to the recognition that Senator McCarthy had to be censured.
Mm. So I'm really glad that you mentioned this. And Jack, I want to turn to you here on this, because the concept of the driving concept of unity of purpose is through and through in your book in terms of how Eisenhower, viewed the purpose of his life, quite frankly, his desire to contribute to American unity. And at the same time, I mean, the McCarthy example shows one of the many ways that America actually was quite deeply divided. And I want to explore some of those ways over the next couple of minutes. But Jack, just your thoughts on what Susan said about either McCarthy or Eisenhower's deep drive to contribute or preserve the unity of purpose in America.
Well, privately, he remarked of McCarthy, "I just don't want to get into a pissing contest with that skunk." he was roundly criticized for being basically not even saying the name of Senator McCarthy. And people felt then, and historians subsequently, that he should have come out stronger and earlier and not just waited for McCarthy to destroy himself. But McCarthy did, and how ironically it was by taking on the army. It was when McCarthy began to, open his hearings into the army, into the scandal that Roy Cohn's friend was not treated well by the army. Eisenhower, I think, must have known he had that McCarthy was on the way out because people had high regard for the services. And then when McCarthy appealed to defend himself against this charges that he had interfered in, that he and Cohn had tried to interfere to make things better for the young man they were favoring as a recruit, McCarthy tried to subpoena documents from the Eisenhower administration, and the president said, "No, I'm not giving them anything." Arthur Schlesinger, the historian, said, "This was the most brazen assertion of executive privilege in the history of the Republic. I'm not giving Congress anything. Sorry. Private conversations, documents, you're not going to get any of it." And, of course, it seemed totally unprecedented then and was certainly in a good cause. And, of course, it's been since eclipsed by Mr. Trump, who wouldn't give Congress anything and was partly impeached for that reason.
Mm. But, Susan, go ahead, Susan, please.
No, I was just going to say, back to Eisenhower's strategy, he's completely, I thought he is completely correct. I mean, there are historians who think he handled it the right way, which was containment, surely without confrontation. But Harry Truman and Dean Acheson, his Secretary of State, had confronted McCarthy, and it only made McCarthy more powerful. So Ike's objectives were to use the bully pulpit to talk about the principles of American free speech, and then behind the scenes persuade the people who actually had power over McCarthy to censure him and to discredit McCarthy's words. Don't forget that, this was the president's own party, and they actually supported McCarthy. So this was actually a very delicate undertaking, and I think it's going to remain a subject of great fascination for many years to come.
Well, yeah, and in fact, in reading some reviews and responses to your book, Susan, I see people pointing out that Eisenhower did not come through this entirely unscathed, right? I mean, to the point of this being his own party, folks are pointing out how there was a time, I think it was in 1950, where President Eisenhower was giving a speech in Milwaukee and decided to not include a paragraph celebrating General George Marshall, right, who had been Eisenhower's mentor, paid the price for that.
Well, this is a fascinating period for me to study, because mm-hmm. Ike is making the transition from being a five-star general where everybody follows orders, right, to retail politics, which is a radically different culture. And he thought, because of the 4 to 5 times that he stood up in his speeches and expressed his admiration for George Marshall and his patriotism, that he was on the record. But he found out the hard way after his speech was leaked without any authorization from candidate Eisenhower. He got sandbagged, basically. And then he learned. And let me tell you, every human being and every leader makes mistakes. The question is, do they learn from their mistakes? He never made that mistake again. He began to run a very, very tight ship around speech drafts and this because he had not approved the original draft. So if that speech had not been leaked, no one would have ever known that an incongruous paragraph about George Marshall had been removed. And that is why it seems so odd that we, the historical community, spends a lot of time on that singular mistake. But I'll tell you, I think, and the diaries are hysterically funny in places about how he is thinking about what it's like to be in retail politics. this was a big one on the learning curve.
Yeah. So you say the diaries are hysterical? I mean, do you remember one or two of the...
One of my favorite sections in there is where in the diaries is where he talks about what is the most difficult thing about being a five-star general or commanding forces. And he says, of course, the hardest part is deciding your own views of what the strategy should be. Then he says, and what about politics? He says, the making up your own mind about how to proceed forward is only the beginning of the problem. And then he describes, the way the lobbyists, this, the who, and you don't know what their motives are. You don't know what they're really trying to accomplish, whether they want your job, blah, blah, blah. And there's just something very funny because it's hysterically written. Mm. So that was at that occasion in Wisconsin is when he realized exactly how different this was. But, Meghna and Jack, one of the reasons he was a successful president and part of the reason these principles were so important is that he could carry them forward, the principles from the war years. He could bring them into the White House. And I would say that it's important to note that he was a great planner. Not only did he use expert opinion, but he didn't believe in off-the-cuff decisions. He never made a decision in a crowded room or even in front of his advisors. He always went off alone and stripped down the problem and then came back with a decision. So many of these things, were very helpful for having a studied approach to very complex, fast-moving issues in the science and technology area, for instance, other mm-hmm. Important times when the social change was underway.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that in particular, in detail, a little bit later in the show. But Jack, jump in here. What do you think about what Susan's saying about how Eisenhower actually the care and deliberation that went into his decision making?
Well, it was a model of that. But Susan mentions his diaries. They gave a whole new light to Eisenhower. He was mocked when he was president for his circumlocutory wool gathering in press conferences. At one famous moment, he said to his press secretary, Jim Haggerty, "Don't worry, Jim, I'll go out and confuse them." And he would. He did. He just went out and talked, and people said, "What is he saying?" Dwight MacDonald actually quipped that if Ike were giving the Gettysburg Address, it would read something like this. "I haven't checked these figures, but 87 years ago, I think it was, a number of individuals organized a governmental setup here in this country. I believe it covered the East states, with this idea that they were following up based on a sort of national independence arrangement and the program that every individual is just as good as every other individual." Well, the diaries show something else. And here's his tart one-liner on William Nolan, who was the Republican leader of the Senate. He said, "In his case, there's no final answer to the question, how stupid can you get?" I mean, that's worthy of stand-up comedy. And what people realized was that Eisenhower, in his public utterances, often was just buying time for himself and trying to insulate himself from uninformed criticism. And of course, intellectuals deplored his way of speaking. But privately, this is how he spoke, with this terse intelligence. He was a gifted wordsmith. And this view of the Eisenhower in the diaries and the Eisenhower in the press conferences gave rise to what Fred Greenstein, in a very important book called The Hidden Hand Presidency, that Ike really was much more in charge than people realized, but he didn't care that he got all the credit. He just let things unfold, and if it fell on a subordinate, so be it. But he had a hands-off approach to leadership that was, in fact, effective leadership, partly because he led through deliberation and the kind of thing that Susan was talking about.
Well, we are talking. Susan, I'm going to have to just jump in here because I've got to take us into a break, and then we'll pick up on some more leadership lessons when we come back. So Susan Eisenhower joins us today. She's author of How Ike Led: The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. Jack Beatty is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. We'll have more in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Susan Eisenhower. She is the granddaughter of President Dwight D. Eisenhower and author of the new book, How Ike Led: The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. Jack Beatty is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. And Susan, I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about Eisenhower and civil rights because, I mean, this unity of purpose, American unity, is such a profoundly important theme in your book. And of course, it's the push for the advancement of civil rights for people of color in this country that to this day continues to challenge that unity. So can you just tell me a little bit about, we had like some momentous things happen under Eisenhower's presidency. I mean, first of all, we had the Brown v. Board decision that desegregated American schools. I mean, what was President Eisenhower's view of, for example, of that decision?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to put Dwight Eisenhower's approach to civil rights in the context of how he would have looked at it. He was a great supporter of civil rights during the war. He integrated some units, and even though it was not Army policy. And I think he came into his presidency verbally supporting civil rights, but he did something way more important, is that he actually developed a coherent strategy for how to address the problem. And what I mean by that is that he would be lucky to have 4, possibly 8 years as president. And what he sought to do was to establish a precedent that could not be rolled back. And he did this by announcing very early in 1953 that he planned to desegregate everything the federal government controlled. And that means that he, in 1953, desegregated Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. schools, even before the landmark bill or Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education. The Supreme Court chief was Earl Warren, of course, mm-hmm. and Earl Warren was an Eisenhower appointment who carried forward overturning the earlier court ruling, Plessy versus Ferguson. So then he also desegregated government contracting and a range of other things that the federal government controlled, including, by the way, desegregating, doing the real fundamental work on desegregating the military, even though the executive order came from Truman, and desegregating DOD schools. So you begin to see where he's going with this. But by far and away, the most pivotal thing he did, because it lasted years beyond his tenure, was to establish federal judgeships that were very clear about no white supremacists need apply. And I think some people be amused in the book to know that he actually appointed a Democrat to the Supreme Court, Justice Brennan, actually in an election year, because he believed that the court system needed to reflect the views of the country, not just his political party. So I think there is a strategic approach. Of course, this culminates at Little Rock, Arkansas, in 1957. And Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne Division after a failure to get the governor of Arkansas to comply with the Supreme Court ruling. And he deployed the 101st Airborne Division to escort nine African-American young people to Central High School in Arkansas. So again, you know, the Eisenhower approach to civil rights was much like his approach in handling other issues. He wanted to put the framework together. Again, he was very sharp about knowing what he controlled and what he didn't, and what he didn't control was state government. And he did not control, you know, the legislative process in our nation of at the state level. But what he could do is enforce the law. And I think his leadership there has been misunderstood, because he understood that given the composition in Congress, let's not forget that the so-called Southern segregationists that is often referred to in history books were actually, you know, led by Lyndon Johnson. He was Johnson was not a segregationist, I don't think, at all. But
yeah,
he certainly had a fractious group there. And so Ike actually compromised with Johnson on the 1957 Eisenhower civil rights bill.
Yeah. So it's, I was just going to say that, like, he had to compromise and eventually signed a much watered down bill from the one he originally introduced. And let me just get Jack's view here on this. I mean, Jack, what do you think? Because Eisenhower's sort of trying to find that middle way to which to achieve an overall framework of unity, as Susan said, did require some compromises on something as critically important as civil rights on occasion.
Yes, and you know, Susan mentioned the Little Rock Nine. She quotes from a letter that the parents of those students sent to Mr. Eisenhower: "We, the parents of nine Negro children enrolled at Little Rock Central High School, want you to know that your action in safeguarding their rights have strengthened our faith in democracy. Now, as never before, we have an abiding feeling of belonging and purposefulness." That's something to be very proud of, it seems to me, in the whole annals of American of the American presidency. You know, the president privately thought that he said, what was the quote? He said, appointing Earl Warren was my worst damn fool mistake. Well, he differed from Warren on many things, including things on domestic security and secrecy and so on. And the president did not come out and say, "I agree with the Brown decision," and he was criticized for that. But he did say, "I will defend the Constitution," and the Constitution says the Supreme Court has spoken, and I will see that it is that its mandate is carried through. And it showed his caution. He didn't believe that you could change morals by law. He thought these things would take a long, long time. He's one of those people, really, that Martin Luther King addresses in his letter from a Birmingham jail, where he's Birmingham jail, where he says, you know, good people of goodwill talk about patience,
right,
and we must be patient. Ike was patient. So were most Americans then, white Americans.
Yeah.
I think, though, Jack, in my book, I make it pretty clear that the reason he didn't speak publicly about Brown outside of the rule of law issue is that he did not, and if you look at the record, he did not speak up about any of the Supreme Court decisions because he didn't want it to make it look like he approved of some of them and disapproved of others. So that was another principle of his leadership. In fact, thanks to Herbert Brownell's book, he was the attorney general at the time. Later, he wrote a memoir that outlined Ike's support for Brown, that if he had any problems with Earl Warren, it was some related to some of those other issues that you you rightly flag.
Well, we're rounding towards the end of the hour here, and I want to play a little bit more of President Eisenhower himself. So let's just listen to his farewell address, or a portion of his farewell address that he gave to the nation in 1961.
We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
President Eisenhower in 1961. Now, Jack, what do you hear in that?
I mean, it's moving, and he's the great warrior talking about love and community and unity, and it's I remember that speech. I was a young man, and what that speech especially is remembered for is his warning, and coming from a military man, of the untoward influence of the military-industrial complex. Originally, it was military-congressional complex, but he was persuaded to take that out. But really, congressional was part of the truth of it, that Congress was in the business of saying yes to any weapon system that would employ people in a congressman's district. And the president was saying this gives a kind of vested interest in war, built into our economy. And that was left wingers took up that whole issue, slogan years later. And it's, I think, among the most prescient and sort of important messages. And it ranks, I think, with Washington's farewell address as a cautionary note to the nation. Beware the vested interest of war built through Congress and defense contracting.
Mm-hmm. And Susan, what do you think?
Well, first of all, Jack has said it so eloquently. I don't know what I can add except to say that, he starts out the speech saying, of course, we have to be ready. Between the two wars, we had literally reduced the military down to a level that, made it impossible to be ready for the next war without a massive scale up. And so it was inevitable. But Jack is completely correct. In terms of the impact of that speech and the fact that he calls out his old comrades, too, which is sort of amazing if you think about it. Publicly warn about, an institution he used to be very much part of, is a rather extraordinary thing. But, let's just remember that Eisenhower was probably our most nonpartisan president since Washington. Or Jack, maybe you've got an idea who might have come to this. Before he ran for president, nobody knew whether he was a Republican or a Democrat because he was a military man. So he, did not feel it was his responsibility to continue to promote the desires of, you know, of any particular segment of his professional life. He, as president, his new goal was to serve all Americans and not just the military or the industry that went with it.
Just got a couple of minutes left, Susan, and I mean, it sounds like it's definitely another era, almost another planet, to hear that a man who ended up becoming president of the United States, that in the first part of his service to the country as a military man, you know, no one even knew what party he belonged to. I mean, we're in a very, very, very different nation politically now. So, I mean, what lessons can be drawn? What lessons should politicians in this country today draw from Eisenhower?
Well, you know, I've thought a lot about that, and I just have to say that the one thing he'd be just so terribly worried about are these deep divisions. And the problem is today that both political parties spend an enormous amount of time playing to their base. Back in the 1950s, I know it went on for subsequent decades. For a long time, you were expected to have a strategy for the whole country. Now elections are conducted in a way that are almost mathematical formulas about how many more people do we need to add on to our base and that type of thing. And I think there's so many things that I learned from writing this book. You know, for instance, he never took a speaking honorarium, never joined a corporate board after his presidency. Mm. He didn't believe that, you know, he should do that. And I think all this gets back to an innate sense of humility and modesty. He believed in a higher cause. And for him, from West Point onwards, it was the United States of America.
Yeah.
So I sort of say in my book, you don't have to like the decisions that he made, but you have to acknowledge what his thought process was as he rolled out his wartime and presidential leadership.
Mm-hmm. Well, Susan Eisenhower, granddaughter of President Dwight D. Eisenhower and author of the new book, How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Susan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, I want to thank you and Jack very much for this opportunity. It was a real treat.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much as well.
Thank you, Megha.
All right. Well, to end this hour, we wanted to hear once more from President Eisenhower. In 1964, 20 years after D-Day, Eisenhower returned to Normandy with CBS's Walter Cronkite, and he talked about his experiences of 1944. And walking along in the Normandy American Cemetery, the former president remembered the sacrifices of the thousands of soldiers who died in that battle. Let's listen. This is On Point.
These people gave us a chance, and they bought time for us so that we can do better than we have before. So every time I come back to these beaches, or any day when I think about that day 20 years ago now, I say once more, we must find some way to work to peace and to really to gain an eternal peace for this world.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title, and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.